The title for this evening's talk is Equanimity, Our Greatest Friend. I'd like to begin with a verse from the Theragata, the early Buddhist songs. If your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes, in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend, and suffering will not come your way. To have your mind be your greatest friend. This is something I think we would all like. It refers to the stability of mind that has equanimity. In Pali, the term is upekkha. Ajahn Chah said, "The heart of the path is so simple, no need for long explanations. Give up clinging to love and to hate. Just rest with things as they are. That is all I do in my own practice." Equanimity implies a complete openness to experience without being lost in the reactions of love and of hate, of liking and not liking, of wanting and not wanting. Equanimity is a powerful quality in its own right, and it fortifies other wholesome qualities of mind. Equanimity endows metta with patience, so that we can stay caring, even as friends who we're sending metta to continue their self-destructive patterns. Without equanimity, we might demand that happiness manifest the way that we want it to. Equanimity also endows compassion, karuna, with courage, to stay present in the face of pain. Even when we care very deeply and try to help, we cannot always help. During the Buddha's life, there was a great lay disciple named Anuttapindika, and he was a very wealthy merchant in Savatthi, and very generous, generous to the Sangha of monks, generous to the Buddha, generous to other recluses and practitioners of other orders, and very generous to his family, to his cousins, to his relatives. He was actually quite renowned for developing this quality of generosity. And he had the means, he had the wealth to share it, and he did. This provided a tremendous support for the development of the Sangha and also for the happiness of everyone around him. Anuttapindika had a relative, though, who was a spendthrift. He was a gambler and a drunk. And he, on a number of occasions, asked Anuttapindika for some funds because he wanted to start a business. So Anuttapindika gave him some capital, some money, in order to start a business. But it wasn't very long before he spent away his money and lost his business. And a short time later would come back to his relative Anuttapindika and ask again for some support to begin a new venture. And Anuttapindika gave it, but again, the relative lost the money and the business failed. This happened a number of times until finally, one time he came to Anuttapindika and he said no. He said he was not going to give him any money. He had not stopped drinking. He was still a gambler, and he had never succeeded in making these businesses work. So he refused to give him any more money to squander. And it wasn't very long after that that the relative continued in his rather reckless ways and ended up dying. And his body was just sort of discarded on a garbage heap outside the city wall, which was sort of a great sadness and disgrace. And when this happened, Anuttapindika went to the Buddha and told him what had happened because he was feeling guilty. Maybe he should have given him the money. Maybe there was something more he could have done. But very interestingly, the Buddha said that basically there was nothing more that he could have done. He was generous to the extent that he could be generous, but he couldn't control what happened to those funds. This was a time when he needed equanimity. We need equanimity when we've tried our best but can do nothing else, when we've tried to help but it hasn't helped, when we've done what could be done and we realize that we can't control the results. We can act out of the best of our intentions, but we cannot actually control what will happen in the future. Equanimity is this very essential and important experience of balance. It brings a radiant calmness and a spacious stillness to the heart and the mind. Equanimity is not withdrawal. It is not indifference. It includes no coldness and no hesitation. These are all subtle forms of aversion. But instead, equanimity accepts and acknowledges the world as it is, in all its perfection, in all its imperfections. And it accepts it anyway. Dolly Parton said, "The way I see it, if you want the rainbow, you got to put up with the rain." One of the guiding principles for equanimity in my own practice has been a teaching that Christopher Titmus, my mentor, has gave me many years ago when we were having a conversation about equanimity, because it was a nice, easy list to remember. It only had two parts. And in this discussion, he told me that there were two important areas to develop equanimity in relationship to. So I thought, okay, I can remember two. The first is pleasure and pain, that swing between what we like and what we don't like, what feels good and what feels bad. And the second area is future results. And so these two areas became my guiding principle for developing equanimity. Anytime there was an experience on the continuum between pleasure and pain, this was a practice of equanimity. And any time there was grasping after trying to control the future, trying to make something happen. And I love to plan. So this was an important one for me. This was an opportunity to practice equanimity. So I want to speak a little bit first about pleasure and pain, because we need equanimity to stay balanced and present in this movement between pleasure and pain. Throughout every day, there are innumerable changes on this continuum of pleasure and pain. I know you all know this by now. Some moments are pleasant. Others are unpleasant. And a vast majority are kind of in between, not quite totally pleasant and not quite totally unpleasant. And many change between the two, a moment of pleasantness, a moment of unpleasantness, and a lot of moments of in between. And it's all life. For the most part, I've discovered that life is beyond what I can control. The truth is there is both pleasant and there is both painful experiences. If I could control it, believe me, I would have picked only pleasant experiences. The very fact that not a single day of my life has occurred that has had only pleasant experiences tells me this is beyond control. Can I accept this? Or will I be tossed and turned between these fluctuations? Or can we instead simply stay steady in the truth of these shifts? Equanimity is the quality of mind that stays steady, that stays balanced and present as it connects as the mind connects with an experience that is pleasant, with an experience that's unpleasant, or with an experience that's neutral. Free from the habitual distortion of grasping what we like, avoiding what we don't like, and spacing out for what is neutral. In the numbered discourses of the Buddha said, just as a rocky mountain is not moved by storms, so sights, sounds, tastes, smells, contacts, and ideas, whether desirable or undesirable, will never stir one of steady nature whose mind is firm and free. So how do we develop this beautiful quality of equanimity? Well, obstacles are a wonderful way of developing equanimity. Obstacles refine and test our balance and our poise, our composure in life. Ram Dass says, life is your curriculum. Do we learn from the complexities and the obstacles that life gives us? Not try to avoid them, predict them, contain them, or control them, but learn from the everyday experiences that give us a chance to cultivate equanimity. On my first trip to India, I had many experiences that demanded the cultivation of equanimity. And those of you who have visited India know that India is an ongoing exploration of equanimity and a lot of sense of humor. I was having some clothes made, one of those Punjabi suits made. So went to the took the cloth, went to the designed the little thing, went to the tailor, had it made, and he told me it would be done sometime, you know, next week. I forgot what day. He gave me a day. So I went back that day. You can tell I was from the States. Nobody would have gone back the day they said. So anyway, he said it would be done, say, on Tuesday. So I went back on Tuesday. And of course it wasn't done. But he told me it would be done tomorrow. I thought that meant tomorrow. So I went back the next day. And he told me it would be done tomorrow. I still thought that meant that it would be done the next day. So I went back the following day. Guess what? He told me it would be done tomorrow. So I came back the next day until I finally learned that tomorrow means sometime in the future when it finally gets done. There wasn't a lot I could do to make him sew faster. But I could develop a little bit of equanimity. I could rest in the experience of being in a rather perplexing and confusing place. There were zillions of experiences in India that just were not the way I would have organized things. You go to a train, and the train is supposed to arrive at such and such a time. 2 hours later, it hasn't arrived. 6 hours later, it hasn't arrived. 10 hours later, it hasn't arrived. And each time there are these announcements over the loudspeaker in Hindi, and I run up to somebody and ask, what did they say? What did they say? Oh, it's coming. It's coming. One time I wanted some aspirin, so I went to a chemistry shop, you know, one of those little chemistry shops. Aspirin, it's a basic item. And I asked for the aspirin, and the man spoke perfect English. There was no language problem. So I asked for aspirin, and he didn't have it. And I knew he understood perfect English because we were having a conversation. And I looked at him with total shock, because it had never occurred to me that a chemistry shop would not stock aspirin. And it happened that there was another Westerner in the chemistry shop, and after the chemist sort of walked over, he leaned over to me and he said, "Welcome to India." Because he had seen that perplexed look of, "I don't believe it." Now, there are lots of little experiences that we develop equanimity in relationship to. Sometimes the big things seem a little bit easier to be present with, actually. I remember when my grandmother was dying. I was with her in the hospital. And she had several heart attacks, and they resuscitated her each time. Until finally, we said no more. And the rest of the family left, and I stayed for a while, and I stayed with her. And she had another one. And so I was just holding her hand as she was taking her last breath. And it was such a profound experience of total presence. It didn't require effort. It was just total presence in something that was utterly incomprehensible. Completely incomprehensible. It wasn't a time that I practiced equanimity, because the situation was profound. But it fell to me to clean her kitchen and her refrigerator. So when I went to her home in the next week and was cleaning out her drawers and cleaning out her kitchen, cleaning out her refrigerator, it was when I was cleaning the refrigerator that I realized how profoundly difficult, actually, this was. It was in the little things that, you know, in the, about the week or so by the time I had gotten to the refrigerator, you know, things were rotting. And there was another level of having to just experience the emotion. And there, in a not very profound experience with the refrigerator door open, I realized the value that this was a time to open to the feeling, but with equanimity, with a complete acceptance of impermanence, a complete acceptance of death and decay and rotting vegetables. So obstacles are a wonderful place for developing equanimity. A large percentage of you are working very actively with developing equanimity around pain, and I honor that. That will bring you tremendous benefit to not force your way through the pain, but to actually rest into the fact of pain in a way that develops an equanimous mind, a heartful attitude, a connection to it. Equanimity is a strong quality, but it's very soft. Mindfulness practice also develops equanimity through seeing what is actually happening without judging it. It's that moment-to-moment acceptance of the unfolding of our experience. Concentration practice also develops equanimity, because it develops the composure, the steadiness, the calmness, that non-reactive stability that is so supportive of equanimity. Steadily returning again and again to the primary object of the meditation. The mind naturally becomes less sticky, less reactive, more steady and equanimous with concentration. Contemplating cause and effect is the specific reflection that the Buddhist tradition offers to develop the quality of upekkha, equanimity. And life develops equanimity. As we open to our experience day to day, with interest, with clarity, equanimity grows. Equanimity is the stable presence of heart in the midst of life, so that we abide equally close to all things. I want to suggest several practical ideas to cultivate equanimity. However, it just occurred to me that this talk is about one thing. Would you mind giving the Hebrew definition of equanimity? just in case anybody doesn't know what the heck I'm talking about. Okay, good. It just occurred to me that if you didn't know what that one word meant, you'd wonder, what the heck is she talking about? Okay, some practical ideas to cultivate equanimity. Sit a bit longer. I sat longer in the last... I love the sitting right before dinner. It's my favorite time of day to practice. For some reason, I always have the clearest sittings, and generally, I like to practice at night too, but you know, everybody has a different rhythm, and that time right before dinner is a really lovely time for me. In the last 2 days, I enjoyed a lovely extended sitting and opened my eyes to see that I wasn't alone. I was enjoying it in a lovely community, and I felt very supported by your presence. And extending the sitting like that, some people sat for an hour and a half there, really practices and develops equanimity because we go beyond what is comfortable. A couple of years ago, I've grown up in California, but in New Mexico, a state in the Southwest, their Dharma teacher moved away and they wanted another Dharma teacher. So they invited me to come down for a couple of years and serve that community. And I did. It's a beautiful place and I spent 2 years in the desert down there. But their teacher before me was very into time. 45 minutes, bong, 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 like right on the dot. So after a couple of weeks of being there, I waited until 52 minutes. Those last 7 minutes may have been the first 7 minutes of meditation that some people there had, because the 45 minutes was familiar to them. They knew that routine. And those 7 minutes, they were... Is she asleep? Is she in jhana? Is she deeply absorbed in deep samadhi? Should we wake her up? They were squirming, they were moving, they were coughing, totally still up until the 45 minutes. And then sit a bit longer. Whatever your pattern is, once in a while, break it. Once in a while, do something different. Extend it a bit. We cultivate equanimity when we sit even when we're tired, even when we don't feel like it, even when we're uncomfortable, even when it's too hot, even when it's too cold, even when we're sick. Being sick is a wonderful time to develop equanimity, because if you're sick and you try to meditate, the mind is foggy, the breath is, you're stuffy, you're sitting there feeling miserable. Fantastic time to practice equanimity, because it's probably the only thing you can practice. So you might as well focus on it. When the bell rings in a retreat like this, very often there's this swell of movement. Settle back in and wait until you're ready to get up so that you're not just carried along in that wave of energy. When an ant walks across you, that's a good time to make a vow for stillness. I'm not into saying for this hour, we're all going to make a vow of stillness, not move. But I think it's very useful individually when you feel calm and when you really want to look into something to say for the next 3 minutes, for the next 5 minutes, for the next 15 minutes, I'm not going to move. And that could be when a fly is walking across you and it's really thirsty and it's starting to drink. Did they do that to you? They did that to me on this one. There was a really thirsty fly and it got right between my lips. That was the time to make a vow of I am not going to move. It can drink. That can be an act of generosity. Because if we move every time there's some discomfort, then we don't practice equanimity. So I encourage stillness, but not forced and not rigid. Just in the moments and the times when you feel the collection of interest and the stability to do it, explore it for however long you decide. 3 minutes is great for the duration of the ant walking across your arm. That all develops a lot of equanimity. Now, situations of inconvenience are a great place to develop equanimity. Coming to a retreat gives you lots of opportunities for that, because I'll bet your bed at home is more comfortable. And the food is great here, but you don't get to order whatever you want. There are lots of times, too, where things just are not quite the way that we want them to be. That's the time for equanimity. If you're driving around Jerusalem and every time you turn somewhere, the road is blocked, it's the time for equanimity. Maybe letting go and going home, too. We need equanimity to be able to compromise in a negotiation, to be able to compromise in a relationship, to be able to endure the various shifts and changes that just happen throughout our days. Rather than shift the blame onto others when things aren't the way that we want them to. It's so easy to blame the institution, to blame the society, to blame the politicians, to blame some other person, or to make a rule so that it won't happen again. Rest within the experience of inconvenience and let that be where one balances. When you have to wait, wait gracefully with equanimity, waiting for an appointment, waiting for a friend, waiting for an airplane that's very late. Equanimity is not only developed in the difficult situations in life, but we also need to stay balanced, not swept off our feet in the moments when things are really going our way, when things are exactly the way we hoped they would, when we're praised, when we're flattered. Because it's very easy to get a little bit overexcited, not just experience excitement with equanimity, appreciate the delight of that energy, but if we're swept away by flatter and the jubilation of the feeling, the thrill, then we'll be very vulnerable to advertisers, to politicians, to con artists, to salesmen, to anyone who uses flattery to get their way. So we need equanimity simply to not be manipulated, but to stay steady and committed to the things that are of deepest value to us. There is a deep, deep happiness that comes with equanimity that's far more exciting than the excitement and thrills of pleasure. In fact, it's described as one of the highest kinds of happiness. Equanimity is consciously developed as a practice of the heart, as one of the four Brahma-viharas. Loving-kindness or metta is the first Brahma-vihara. Brahma-vihara is translated as divine abode, or the qualities of heart that make life divine. Loving-kindness is the first. Compassion is the second. Appreciative joy is the third, and equanimity, upekkha, is the fourth of the Brahma-viharas. This is a system of training that cultivates these four specific qualities by the repetition of phrases. And I want to share with you the phrase that is used for the development of upekkha. It's kind of long, so bear with me. Even for entirely English-speaking audiences, it's a doozy. So, all beings are the heirs of their own karma. Their happiness or unhappiness depends upon their actions, not what I may wish for them. And we very often shorten it to, may I accept things as they are, or may I be open and balanced, or may I find peace and equanimity with things. But regardless of which phrases we recite and contemplate, equanimity matures when we contact what is difficult without being thrown off balance by it, because we understand that things arise due to causes and conditions. We cannot control the results of our actions, even when we act in the best of our intentions and we try as hard as we can, or relax as hard as we can, or let go as well as we can, or whatever it is. We still can't control the results of the actions, because so many conditions collide to create the next moment, to produce the result. Life just doesn't conform to the way that we organize it. It doesn't abide by our plan. It's helpful to watch for the little imperatives or ultimatums, demands that we make upon our experience. The thought, I must have it, or it must be this way. If you find yourself caught up in this demanding way of relating to experience, the first thing to do is to simply bring attention to that experience in the body, in the mind. Feel that contraction, feel that energy. Actually feel your own response to that compelling energy. It's not going to feel nice, but we have to feel it anyway. Mindfulness can have a balancing effect, and we may not need to do anything more. With wisdom, we naturally prefer the happiness and the relaxation, the ease that comes from a balanced mind. So mindfulness and slowing down helps a lot. Whenever I notice this demanding energy, this compelling energy, this energy that wants to go out and control the situation because it doesn't like what is happening, as much as I can, I pause. I feel a breath. I feel my feet on the earth, and I'm clear where I'm standing physically and where I'm standing emotionally, so that I can bring a sense of presence into my action, and not keep falling off balance into the attempt to make something happen or control the future. Whenever we're reactive, whether it's in relationship to the pleasant experience, wanting more of it, or the unpleasant experience, wanting less of it, our experience is riddled with suffering and self-interest. Equanimity decenters self-interest. It decenters selfishness. It lets us abide with the simple truth of things beyond our personal preferences. There's a verse from the third Zen patriarch that says, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail." Equanimity is a lovely and very smooth way of relating to our experience. It can be so lovely that it can be confused with freedom. some years ago, I undertook a personal retreat to explore the Brahma-viharas, those four qualities. I did 2 months of loving-kindness practice and then divided the next 2 months between the other three qualities of compassion, joy, and equanimity. And during the equanimity section, you know, I was pretty warmed up by then. It was really cool. Really a wonderful feeling. Because once I plodded through the practice for a little while and developed the quality, when you focus on the Brahma-viharas as your soul practice, so you're doing intensive Brahma-vihara practice, that quality completely infuses the mind, and the mind becomes saturated, completely saturated with whatever the quality is. In those weeks, it was equanimity. So it pervades every experience. And for quite some time, there was absolutely no experience of desire or aversion. The mind didn't move towards the pleasant or away from the unpleasant. It was just pleasant and unpleasant. There was no movement of the mind in relationship to it. And it was quite a long stretch where I was very mindful and I was wondering, well, I usually really want this, you know, like my afternoon tea or something, but there was no movement toward it. And this notion sort of arose that, you know, not only is this really cool, but I'm free of desire and aversion. And the feeling in the heart was very cool, very balanced, very saturated. So I went into my interview, maybe with a little more pride than I was aware of. And it was with my mentor, Christopher Titman, who fortunately has known me for more than 20 years, so he can forgive just about anything. Anyway, in the conversation, I rather implied that I was free. That desire and aversion had been eradicated. Now, I didn't say that. I mean, I wouldn't say that. But I thought it. And it was clearly implied in the way that I was describing my experience. And he just leaned back and reminded me very simply that equanimity is a conditioned state. It's a profound state, an extraordinary state, to experience the peace of desirelessness, of the mind without desire, without hate. But it is a conditioned state. It depends upon certain conditions. It's an extraordinary quality of the heart and the mind. It's necessary in life, and it's absolutely vital to our practice. But it is still a relative quality of mind. It is not the aim and not the goal of our practice. I and mine still operate, even within deep states of equanimity, as the subtle position of the meditator, of the one who feels equanimous. That very sense of being the one who was unreactive, the one that was free, was the bondage. And it reveals it simply reveals the limitations of equanimity, the conditionality of that state. Even equanimity with its extraordinary bliss must be seen for what it is. This is not to underestimate the strength of steadiness or the importance of cultivating this quality, but simply to know that it's a conditioned state. It may feel like liberation, but there may still need to be work that needs to be done. Even when the mind is not so coarse that it's compelled to move with desire towards what it likes and aversion towards what's painful, if there's still an experiencer, an I position, it's not freedom. As one colleague of mine told me, as long as there is an I, there is still work to be done. Let's sit for a few minutes.